I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200 percenters. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, it's Behind the Bastards. That's right.
It certainly is.
It certainly is. You can't argue about that. That is a fact that is as undeniable as it is undeniable that someone in the subreddit will decide to argue with us about that point, because that is what they like to do. I'm Robert Evans, host of Behind the Bastards, where just a couple of weeks ago I made a comment that I will not be calling mummies mummified persons because I like mummies. And somebody took offense at that on behalf of the mummies. And I'm just going to tell you right now, Abbott and Costello versus the mummified person, terrible, terrible name for a movie. So we're not going back. Never. Anyway, Mia, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm here. I'm gonna make a non-legally actionable statement, which is that if I remember correctly, the Oriental Institute stole their entire everything that's there is stolen. So
for sure,
non-legally actionable. This is just what I remember off the top of my head.
Yeah,
be great.
Yeah. It's one of those things. People were like, well, you know, it's important to acknowledge the humanity of these mummies because a lot of them were stolen. And I was like, no, it's important to give them back because a lot of them were stolen.
Yeah.
We can still call them mummies. The problem is not that people were calling them mummies. It's that they stole dead people.
Like, yeah, and then ate them.
Yeah.
Which is
yeah.
great.
The issue is not that we used the term mummy. Let it be, everybody. Anyway, I'm very mummy-pilled.
I'm very glad you're mummy-pilled, but
thank you, Sophie.
Probably introduce our guest, Mia Wong.
Mia Wong, how are you doing today on the podcast that it is right now?
Normally,
you're on another podcast, but today you're on this one.
Yeah, I have hijacked this podcast in order to chess.
Oh, God. We're talking about chess again?
Yes, which I really am realizing is, if it wasn't a hack and a fraud, I would have actually asked you before we did this, if you actually play chess at all?
Well, again, there's no orcs in chess, so no,
that's
of course
true.
Not. No, when I was
true.
A child, I played a few games of chess, and then I was introduced to the true game of skill, Warhammer 40,000 3rd Edition. And so that's the only strategy game I ever needed.
You know, considering the minds of every single person in this story who plays chess, I think this is actually a wise decision. It does something to your brain. That's what I've learned after many hours of reading about chess players is
yeah.
something fundamentally breaks in your brain when you play chess for this long.
That does not surprise me. It seems like the kind of thing that people get extremely into make it the entire core of their identity, much like Warhammer 40,000, but again, without orcs.
Yes, but similar numbers of fascists, as we're going to find.
Yes, yes, that also does not surprise me to hear.
Oh, God. Okay, so speaking of Nazis and fascists, one of the sort of elements of this story that is kind of important is getting some kind of understanding of how good these people are at chess, because
sure.
none of the story makes any sense unless... You know, the people doing this are genuinely prodigiously good. So I'm gonna start this with a brief tangent about a man named Miguel Najdorf. So Miguel Najdorf is not a bastard. He is very cool, and his life story is very sad. He He was born to a Jewish family in Poland in 1910, which is...
Oh, that's not going to go well.
So, no, yeah, you can tell where this is going to go.
Boy.
So...
one of the bottom times to be born to a Jewish family in Poland, 1910. Yep. That's right, because you're going to be old enough to be fully aware of how bad things are going.
Yep. So...
magical realism for you.
Oh, God. Yeah, no. Yeah. This story is going to get very bleak very quickly.
Yeah.
So... Najdorf, as a kid, it's very clear that he's very, very good at chess. He very rapidly becomes a grandmaster, which is the highest official rating in chess. So there's this organization called FIDE, or the International Chess Federation, and they basically run chess after like a certain period of time. You could do like 17 episodes just about FIDE politics. It's nonsense. I don't understand how this chess organization has so much political drama, but it does. Mm-hmm. But so in 1950, FIDE creates the rank of international grandmaster, and they choose 27 people to be the first grandmasters. Najdorf is one of them. These days he's famous. Yeah, he's a mighty player.
Have to have a pretty good strategic mind to make it out of Poland in that period of time. You gotta be a thinker.
he gets out of Poland, but he's out of Poland when everything goes to shit because he's playing a tournament in Argentina.
Oh, ooh, boy, wow, that's... There's a comment to make there, given the history of Argentina and the people who made Poland be a problem. But I don't know what it is right now, so we should probably just move on.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I will say about it is that there are a lot of Jews who fled to Argentina before this was happening. So do not automatically assume that someone with a European last name in Argentina is a Nazi, because there's actually a good chance that they're, like, someone who is fleeing the Nazis.
Well, that's awkward. But it makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So Najdorf today, I think, is probably most famous as, like, there's an opening in chess called the Najdorf, or technically speaking, its full name is the Sicilian Defense, the Najdorf Variation. So, we're going to do a little bit of, we're going to do, like, one thing of chess terminology, which is that chess is this thing called openings.
Okay.
And they're like, standard sets of moves that people play at the beginning of the game. Yeah. And now, you know, if you have an opening named after you, it is because you were an important player in the history of chess.
Okay.
And Najdorf's opening, this might not be true, but I'm pretty sure it's like the most studied opening in the history of chess.
Yeah, I mean, like, at my game store back when I played Warhammer 40,000, there was a move that everybody called a Robert, and it was when somebody did something so stupid with their army that it led to a victory because the other person simply didn't conceive of somebody doing something that dumb.
I once beat an 1800 in tournament. Like, an 1800 is like a pretty seriously good chess player. I was like a not very good chess player, but I once beat him because I did that. I played so badly that he stopped paying attention. He put his queen down, and then I took it.
There's nothing more dangerous than an idiot with a trick up his sleeve.
Yep.
It's the most dangerous thing in the world. Or at least in wargaming. Anyway.
Yeah, so, okay. So
I'm going to talk about Warhammer a lot during this, Mia.
Yes. I hope you're ready. The conclusion that I had about Bobby Fischer is there's two ways to write about Bobby Fischer, right? Mm-hmm. Bobby Fischer is going to be the subject of this show. There's one way where you talk about chess a lot, and then there's another way where you talk about genocide a lot. And everyone has already done the one where you talk about chess a lot, so I'm going to do the one where you talk about genocide a lot instead of that.
Sure.
So, speaking of genocide, okay, so how good is Najdorf at the game of chess? Here's The Guardian talking about how many games Najdorf could play at one time while blindfolded. For decades, Miguel Najdorf's 45 games at Sao Paulo in 1947 stood as the record.
Najdorf had
stayed 45. Najdorf had stayed in Buenos Aires when the war broke out during the 1939 Olympiad and took up blindfold displays in the hopes that the news of his achievements would reach his relatives in Poland, who had actually perished in concentration camps.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's a lot. There's a lot there.
Yeah.
Playing 45. The desperation that is behind playing 45 games of chess at once so your relatives in the Holocaust will know that you achieved something is, like, it's both deeply impressive and, like, heartbreaking in a really specific way that I don't think I've encountered before. But I get it.
It's, I don't know. This is one of the things. The political backdrop of chess is just really bleak. Like, one of the things that's going on this period is Najdorf keeps trying to play... this guy named Alekhine, who was the world champion, and Alekhine is a Nazi, and he like just is not able to play Alekhine because bullshit just keeps happening. But yeah, chess is a game that very, very quickly gets enfolded in this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That said, we can look back at what sort of Najdorf like did here in order to like have a chance to see his family again. And, you know, okay, so what was he actually doing? The answer is he is playing 45 people at the same time in his mind.
Yeah, yeah, purely just kind of keeping track of the movements in his head. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't find his actual win rate, like, for these. But, you know, most of the times when people do simulcasts like this, they win almost all of these games. And, you know,
yeah,
Yeah. Yeah, and like, this is the kind of person that is, like, Bobby Fischer is better than Najdorf, and this is the kind of thing Najdorf can do. So this is the level of chess that everyone in this story can do, right, is they can do things like playing 45 games of chess in their mind at the same time.
Yep, I mean, yep, okay.
Yeah, and this is sort of the justification for everything that we're going to see in this story, right? Like, chess is a game
really good
that,
at chess.
Yeah, this is the justification for, like, literally people like physically turning their backs on like actual genocides going on. Is that?
I mean, people don't need chess as an excuse to do that.
Oh yeah, no, but they're absolutely
going to use
it. I
would go so far as to say the normal reaction to a genocide is to turn your back on it.
Yeah. But, you know, okay, they're going to excuse a just incredible amount of stuff, specifically because one man was really, really good at chess, and he was also from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that man is Bobby Fischer.
Oh, boy. Now, most of my knowledge of Bobby Fischer comes from a Hilltop Hoods song called Cosby Sweater. So I know very little about him, other than that he was good at chess.
Yeah, that's... Okay, so there are two important things about Bobby Fischer. One is that he's very good at chess. The second one is that he's a Nazi.
Oh, and gosh.
We will be establishing both of these over the course of this episode.
Okay. Chess so, Nazi. All right. Well, there's our title, so that's good. Sophie, mark that off the to-do list. Chess Nazi Bobby Fischer, solid title. That'll keep everybody happy.
Yeah, the words Bobby Fischer, chess Nazi, this is the closest I've ever come to divine inspiration. They just appeared in my head one day, and I was like, I need to do this episode now.
That's good. So, I mean, I feel like if a Nazi is good at chess, that's an easy case for just push that fellow in a river. Put some heavy rocks in their pockets, right in a river. We don't need a Nazi to be good at strategy and just kind of hanging around society. That's not going to help anybody.
You would think, but it's chess, and what the thing that happens when a Nazi's good at chess is everyone like gives them a bunch of money.
Well, I don't like that either. Although, yep, okay, I don't like that either. But I guess it does show that chess isn't really good for anything.
Not really, no. So, okay, but Bobby Fischer was not born rich. He's born on March 9th, 1943 at the Michael Reese Hospital in Chicago. And I need to make an important note at the beginning here. We do not claim this man. Fuck this guy. This guy's not a Chicagoan. He leaves very quickly.
I mean, you can tell it's bad because his hospital was named after the current sheriff of Multnomah County in Portland, Mike Reese. Who sucks anyway.
Amazingly, that is not the only person in this story who is going to have the same name as a guy from Portland who sucks.
Oh, wow. That's okay. I'm excited for this.
Yeah.
We have a lot of guys who suck, though. So the odds are always pretty good.
Yep. So, all right. Regina Fischer who's Bobby Fischer's mother, she is a wild character. She is a longtime, very committed communist. She's doing activism for so long.
The worst Nazis start as communists. That's yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, Fischer's never really a communist, but like his mom is like she's so dedicated to like this.
She's a communist, yeah.
The other complicated part about the story is at least his mom, and there's questions over who Bobby Fischer's dad is. I don't think are that interesting, but at least half of his family is Jewish, and Bobby Fischer still turns out like this. His mom, so the reason she's in the U.S. is that she had been like making a living like in the Soviet Union, and then anti-Semitism got so bad at her Stalin that she had to flee.
Ooh.
And so you know, she's now in the U.S. And when she gives birth to Bobby, she's like completely broke. She is a homeless single mother. And so after about a week, they kick her out of the hospital and they're like, OK, well, where do we send this person? And she gets sent to this hospice for single mothers.
Great country. I bet this was a nice place. Well funded. Had a lot of respect for single mothers.
OK, here's the thing. If she had been allowed to stay there, it probably would have been kind of okay. The problem is that the way the hospice worked was that it's only supposed to take care of parents and newborns. So Regina has another daughter, or has a daughter who's like very young.
Okay.
And she tries to bring the daughter to this hospice thing, and they are immediately like, you need to leave. And she's like, no, I have a literally a week old baby and another child, and I have no home. So she tries to stay there, and they call the cops.
Cool.
And not all, and this isn't just like a, like they, you know, the CPD arrests her, and this isn't even just like an arrest. It's not even just like they take her in and like whatever. They prosecute her for this.
Jesus Christ.
And
I love the idea of like the, I got a job working at a hospice for single mothers because I want to take care of the next generation. What? She has a child that's slightly too old? Send her to prison.
Yep.
Like, geez, my God.
It's so bad. Like, the judge looks at this and is like, what are you guys doing here? Just like, he's like, okay, give her a psych eval and let her go. Which, like, this is a Chicago judge in 1943. That is a terrifying individual. That guy probably sentenced 8 guys to death like that morning for being slightly too queer. And even he's like, what you're trying to put a single mother in prison for trying to stay in a hospice for single mothers.
This is definitely like the two parts of me are warring here, because on one hand, this is an almost unthinkable nightmare. But on the other hand, I'm very pro child prison. So this is really tough for me, you know?
Well, here's the thing. The children are too young to do labor. So what's the point of child prison? Like, you can't put a 1 week old in
child prison.
Children
are never too young to do labor. They can. I've seen 1 week olds. They can pick up blocks. We have a lot of blocks in this country that need to be picked up. Look, in aggregate, they can do a lot of work. That's all I'm saying.
You've watched too many Andrew Tate Hustler University videos.
You gotta get those kids working. Look, if they're not paying rent, they're just, I don't sucking up.
Really,
I keep trying to find a way to. I'm trying to continue
this
joke,
podcast.
But all of the different lines that come to me are literal pieces of Nazi propaganda. So it's probably best just to move on.
So, all right, the first few years of Bobby's life, they are moving constantly. Regina holds like half a dozen jobs in like 9 states. And she's like, I mean, this is the middle of World War II, so it's slightly easier to find a job than it would be. In 1938 or something.
Sure.
But, you know, she's trying to like work enough to keep her family together and keep her kids fed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this means that Bobby's childhood is kind of a mess.
It doesn't sound good. No.
Yeah. But one thing that emerges very early is that Bobby loves games. His biographer, Frank Brady, who writes a really good book about probably the best like biography of Bobby Fischer, called Endgame: Bobby Fischer's Remarkable Rise and Fall, that I'm going to be using for a lot
good.
Of this.
So there is a fall. That's good.
There's definitely a fall. Well, I'll give a minor spoiler here is Bobby Fischer is the first person to be canceled for making fun of 9/11, and maybe the only person who deserves to be canceled for it. So it does eventually go badly for him, but
okay, that's good.
That is, it is currently 1949. So that's going to take a while. But Frank Brady tells the story about how Bobby, like, he starts playing Parcheesi and he really likes the strategy of Parcheesi, but every time a random thing happens, he just loses his mind. And so, okay, so he seems to have he has a brain that's very good at solving puzzles. And at age 6, he buys a chess set.
What do you mean is he doesn't like the fact that like Parcheesi is based in part on like rolling of dice? Like he can't
handle
the fact
that
there's an element of chance.
Yeah.
Again, he doesn't have the raw human courage necessary to play Warhammer.
No,
tragic.
And that's like he could never have cut it as a Hearthstone player.
No.
Which is why I maintain
not.
I'm better at that game than he ever would have been.
Yeah.
But okay, so unfortunately, he discovers chess, and at like 6 years old, he buys a chess set for $1, and he starts playing it with his family, and his family is like, "I don't want to play chess with you," but Bobby just like wants to play chess constantly. So he starts doing something very strange, which is he just starts playing games against himself.
I mean, that makes sense. Yeah,
like I have done this before when I was really, really bored back, like before smartphones existed. And
yeah, when the Lewy body dementia was taking my grandmother, she would just play solitaire over and over and over and over and over and over again. So that makes sense to me.
But the thing with playing chess against yourself is that you know what the other person is doing because you're both people. And so
it's kind of exciting. I mean, I play a lot of you can play Heroes of Might and Magic 3 on your phone, and you can do a hot seat mode. I've played both sides of that. That can be fun sometimes. I'm with him on this, is what I'm saying.
Like, I kind of get it, but like he does this like literally all the time. Like, is this like what he spends his days doing?
Yeah, it's more of a way to pass time on a flight, but
yeah. So Bobby likes this a lot, and you know, this does not make him a normal kid. He's really bad at making friends. And also, you know, the part of his life is sort of genuinely sad is that he's alone after school ends. He's alone basically constantly because his school gets out before his sister's does. And then his mom is almost never home because she has to work like night shifts and day shifts to sort of like keep the whole family there. So she doesn't get home till super late. And okay, so Bobby has to find something to do. And the thing that he does, and he's doing this as like a pretty small child, like he's like 7 or 8 when he starts doing this, is he starts just reading chess books and like playing through the games on his board.
Oh boy. Okay. And,
you know, okay. So on the one hand, he doesn't really have anyone to play against. But on the other hand, if you want to train, like, you know, if you want to train like a 6-year-old to be really good at chess, like eventually this is what you do, right? If you want to get good at chess, you sit down with a bunch of books and you study them. And he's going to keep doing this literally his entire life. It gets to a point where this is the only thing he does with his time is just sit there and read chess books and articles.
Again, I've made similar choices with Warhammer 40,000 in my past.
The extent that Bobby's doing this, he is reading so many chess books that even like the Soviet chess grandmasters who are literally paid by the state specifically to study chess are like, how are you reading this much stuff? And he's just like, it's the only thing in my life.
My entire world is empty of anything but chess. And our entire world, Mia and mine, our entire world is empty of everything except for the products and services that support this podcast. We live in a dank void surrounded by the results of unchecked capital exploitation.
So lots and lots of gold.
Yeah, buy some gold.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I do get like 10 to 15 messages a day about the gold ads.
Yeah, well, and you love that, Sophie. That lets you feel like you're not alone.
I know, guys. I see you.
Look, I am a big fan of people reaching out to us and letting us know that there are random ads from a shady gold company going into our thing. Please continue to do that. Every day, Sophie messages me and says, my life has been improved by the fact that people are complaining about these random gold ads. Don't just skip ahead by like 30 seconds or a minute using the button on your phone. Message Sophie. She loves it and it makes her feel wanted and like she has a wide and broad base of friends out on the internet. Just checking out to her, letting her know there's gold ads on the show. So please keep doing it, everybody.
One of the upsides of podcasts is that none of you ever get to see the faces Sophie makes during this.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes my life better and makes your life worse, and this makes me happy.
Mm-hmm.
Just know that my face said, "I hate you, Robert Evans."
I know.
I hate you.
I know.
But you know and who I that... don't hate? Mia Wong.
Oh.
All right then.
Yay.
Let's rock on.
Yes. Let us return to the world of Bobby Fischer as a very small child. So, all right, Bobby Fischer's mom is very concerned about the fact that he's just sitting around playing chess all the time, but doesn't have anyone to play chess with. So she emails a chess guy at like the local newspaper and is like, hey, can you find someone for my like 7-year-old child to play with? And for reasons I do not understand, this guy is like, yeah, here, go play at this simultaneous exhibition that this like chess master is going to be holding. So yeah, chess masters do these things where they're called simuls, where, you know, like, you know, we talked about Nazdrov doing one of these, right? I mean, normally they're not blindfolded, but it's a guy shows up and like you show up and like 30 of you just get destroyed by this guy. So this newspaper editor is like, okay, send Bobby Fischer to play against like this incredibly strong American player. And the result of this is that 7-year-old Bobby Fischer just gets absolutely annihilated and then starts crying because he's a 7-year-old and he's just like gotten destroyed in public. And this is an interesting sort of event in Bobby's life because people make a lot out of this. Like when you read biographies, people are like, this is a critical moment. And like, it probably kind of is, but also like, I don't know, he's a 7-year-old. It turns out when this happens to a 7-year-old, they cry because they're 7.
I mean, it's still toughen up a little bit. Come on, kid.
Yeah. People expect really weird, like people keep asking, like people like throughout his entire life, people would ask Bobby Fischer about the games that he played when he was 7. And they're like, do you remember these games? It's like, this man is seven. Like, come on. Why do you, the chess writer, expect this guy to remember a game that he played at age seven? I don't know. I've been sort of continuously baffled by chess writers as I've been.
Chess writer does kind of presuppose a few things about a person. I guess I'm not surprised that someone who would pick that as a living would want, like, question somebody in depth about a series of games they played when they were too young to be fully conscious of the world. That makes sense to me. If someone were to interview me about being seven, I have moderately strong memories of herding a bunch of cows with a broomstick. In my fucking back 40, but that's about it. I remember the time my dog got skunked and then ran into the house and skunked the entire house. And I remember getting not the big Lego pirate ship, but I had a good report card and my mom got me the small Lego pirate ship, and that was the best day of my childhood.
You know,
it was fucking dope ass pirate ship, everybody.
So someone should have got Bobby Fischer this thing so he didn't turn into Bobby Fischer and instead had a cool pirate ship.
One Lego pirate ship could have solved a lot of problems.
Yep. Instead, unfortunately, what happens is that, there's a guy who is the president of the Brooklyn Chess Club who, like, sees the seven-year-old playing this game. And he's like, wow, the seven-year-old's actually pretty good. And he invites him to join the Brooklyn Chess Club, which is very weird because the Brooklyn Chess Club is, like, it's a very prestigious organization. It's like we're like doctors and lawyers and stuff go to play chess, and they don't allow children in. But the president's like, nah, I'm making an exception for this, like, seven-year-old. And so Bobby shows up, and nobody wants to play him because, this is a sort of a thing that's, I think, kind of special about over-the-board chess that you don't get with very many other things, which is that over-the-board chess is one of the few games you can play where you sit down and there's a seven-year-old across from you, and the seven-year-old just destroys you.
Yeah, I mean, Warhammer actually would be one of the others, but...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they're kind of rare now. But the problem is, okay, so Bobby Fischer shows up and nobody wants to play with him.
Cool, it would be cool if football worked that way.
Oh, my God.
Like, full contact football, throw some seven-year-olds on the field. Now let's see if they're prodigies. Put them up against these 350-pound steroid monsters. See how it goes. All right, what? Kid. After the snap, there's no more rules.
I mean, you know, I was saying, so they throw Bobby Fischer into this pool and it goes about as well as you would expect a baby fighting, like, a guy in full football shit, which is he gets run over and destroyed, like, continuously.
Yeah. Awesome. That's good. That's good for kids.
Yeah. But unfortunately, he, like, just keeps doing this. And so he, like, even like, progressively more and more of his time is consumed by chess. It gets to the point where, like, he has this, like, little chess set, and his chess set is just, like, covered in crumbs and, like, stains of all the food that he's eating while he's playing chess. And this gets to a point that's like, I'm going to read this thing from Endgame, which is that Fischer biography. He even maintained his involvement with the game while bathing. The Fishers didn't have a working shower, just a bathtub. And Bobby, like many young children, needed to be urged to take at least a weekly bath. Regina established a Sunday night ritual of running a bath for him, practically carrying him up to the tub. And once he was settled in the water, she'd lay a door from a discarded cabinet across the tub as a sort of tray, and then bring in Bobby's chess set, a container of milk, and whatever book he was studying at the time, help him get into position them on the board. Bobby soaked sometimes for hours as he became engrossed in the games of the greats, only emerging from the water prune-like when Regina insisted.
Ew, the milk of it all really just added to the visuals. It's not right. I don't like that.
Yeah, that's not my favorite thing that I've heard.
To Regina's credit, see, she actually
This is why we. Okay, I don't know. I'm on shower gang now. I'm fully shower pilled. I'm a shower cell. So.
I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think a bath was a lovely thing. And now it's been milkified and dorified.
That sounds horrifying.
Yeah, it sounds like
a scene from one of the later Alien movies where one of those androids has been wounded and they've got white milky blood gooping out everywhere. Gross.
So thanks for that, Mia.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So as you can see, this is a very normal child.
Yeah, sounds like a great childhood.
Yeah, unfortunately, he's
taking his milk baths. He's getting his ass beaten by adults. reading lots of weird chess books sounds healthy.
Yeah, so
I can't see how this guy turns out to be Fash.
Oh! Don't worry, we are literally right about to get to that. So
great.
Okay, the problem is that he just keeps getting better at chess, but by the time he's 12, he's like actually really good at the game. Like he's playing real tournaments, he's beating people who are actually good at chess. And at this point, Bobby becomes involved with the extremely wealthy chess patron E. Flory Locks, who arranges for him to go on this like chess trip around the U.S. and then go to Cuba to like play chess against Cuban chess players.
Okay, what do we know about this guy? Because that's okay.
From
that does sound a little bit sketchy.
Oh yeah, Locks frequently wore a small black enameled lapel pin bearing a gold Nazi swastika.
Oh boy.
Amazingly, oh boy. It never seemed to attract much attention. He didn't wear it all the time,
what?
But often enough.
What? You wear that once, then people should be like, yeah, fuck, man. That's
It's okay. Wild.
Great.
And it didn't seem to inhibit him when he was in a Jewish delicatessen to get his favorite sandwich of pastrami on rye or when he was talking to Jewish chess players. One player will.
Why didn't it affect him?
Yeah, I don't know. This is like right after the Holocaust. I
honestly, it shouldn't have mattered if it was before the Holocaust.
No,
but like you shouldn't be able to go anyway.
Would think.
Cool.
This just keeps getting worse. So at one point there is a player who gets embarrassed when he walks it and you know, he walks into this restaurant and nobody says anything about it. Here's some more stuff just about who this guy is. In addition to the pin, Locks often wore, weather permitting, a small-brimmed alpine fedora with a feather in the band, adorned with emblems from countries he traveled to.
Absolutely not. Okay.
he ostentatiously dressed in lederhosen at times, and for a few years even sported a Hitlerian mustache.
Uh-huh.
When he entered tournaments dressed in khaki shirt and pants and dark tie and displaying that mustache, it was as if the doppelganger of Der Fuhrer had been reincarnated. In his home hung Nazi flags in prominent locations and displays of airplanes, models of Messerschmitts and Junkers, as well as 75
and Junkers.
Yeah, Messerschmitts. Yeah, sorry. I'm not a World War
II
person. Look, the German language is accursed.
That's true.
Yeah, he also has just like a bunch of he's like a giant oil painting of Adolf Hitler in his house and like a bunch of Third Reich memorabilia. So this guy's great.
Yeah, he sounds dope.
Yeah, the next line from this book was Lax was inarguably one of the most eccentric people in the New York chess community, which like I guess eccentric is a way that you could describe this guy walking around in the Nazi pin with the Hitler mustache and lederhosen.
That is certainly eccentric.
So later on in his life, right, but by the time he's about 16, he's on this tour when he's like, I think like 13. When he's like 16 or 17, Bobby's going to be like a very serious anti-Semite. And, you know, people are always like, well, how did this happen? And it's like, well, it might have been the fact that he was hanging out with this Nazi guy as like a 12-year-old.
That might have had an impact.
And also on the trip to Cuba is this guy named Norman T. Whitaker, who, quote, had also been in prison for car theft and for raping a 12-year-old. When he was in his 60s, he proposed marriage to a 14-year-old. So this is a great crowd of chess players that we've assembled here.
A real luminaries in the field. Best of the best. God.
Yeah. Frank Brady also notes, quote, Bobby sat up in front between the fascist and the con man, which is called foreshadowing.
Sounds like dad's doing a great job, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, this is where your kid's got to be. Yeah. Keep him there.
Well, his dad is like fucked off somewhere.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. It's, I don't know.
It's good. No, this sounds fine. I can't wait to hear how well the rest of the story goes.
Well, the problem is he just keeps winning at chess. So at age 13, he wins the U.S. Junior Chess Championship, which is like nuts. And okay, unfortunately, I do have to talk about one game of chess because Bobby Fischer plays. I mean, he plays a lot of famous games of chess. He plays one very famous one at age 13, where. Yeah. Okay, so this game gets dubbed the game of the century. People talk about it literally all the fucking time. I'm sick of it. I'm very angry. This game's fine. He plays like he's playing like a very strong international master. And you know he plays a pretty cool game where like he like sacrifices he famously like sacrifices his queen and then uses his queen sacrifice to like get this attack and does all this stuff with his knights and his rooks and everyone is like
chess,
loses
chess.
Their minds.
Yeah, exactly. Unbelievable.
Yeah, and, you know, okay, on the one hand, like, this is a pretty good game of chess. On the other hand, I can open YouTube right now and find, like, 1,000 games of chess that are way cooler than this that aren't the product of, like, domestic Operation Paperclip. So... This is the extent of which I'm going to talk about the game of the century because I'm sick of people talking about it.
Okay.
But unfortunately I do have to mention here that chess people will like attempt to murder me in my sleep. So yeah, chess people, I hope you're now satisfied. I have briefly covered this one game.
See, I'm not worried about that at all. I feel like I could beat the shit out of chess people in a fight.
They spend all their time reading chess books. Mm-hmm. They have suspiciously high level state contacts. Which is not a, I don't know, you wouldn't think that was true, but these guys know a lot of intelligence agencies.
Yeah, well, that's fair.
So at age 14, Bobby Fischer becomes the American chess champion. And Robert, you might be asking, how did a 14-year-old win the U.S. Open and become the American chess champion? And part of it is just that the Americans suck at chess.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And the other thing that's going on here is that Bobby Fischer, you know, okay, so like he realizes that Americans aren't very good at chess, and so he learns Russian in order to read Russian chess books. And he just keeps doing this his entire life. He just keeps learning languages, like specifically to read chess books that are in other languages. And so, you know, he starts reading these things. And, you know, while all of this is happening, Bobby Fischer starts getting investigated by the FBI.
Okay.
Which, okay, so
bad, right? You don't want to get investigated by the FBI.
Yeah, he's being investigated by the FBI for like a third of his life, but somehow it's the third of his life where he doesn't think that he's being investigated by the FBI.
Oh. Well.
Which is a very, very strange. So the reason this is happening is that the FBI thinks that his mom was working for the Soviets.
Okay.
And, okay, it turns out that not only was she not working for the Soviets, she'd actually gotten kicked out of the Communist Party, but, you know, it's the FBI. They're not going to let something as petty as, you know, reality get in the way of their sort of domestic, like, espionage operations. And this gets, like, so serious that, like, they are, the FBI is infiltrating TV shows, like, the crews of TV shows that Bobby is going on to, like, see if he's a Soviet spy. His mom starts drilling him about what to say if the FBI shows up at your door, which is apparently, quote, I have nothing to say to you.
Yep, that is, no, I mean, that is the thing that you say if the FBI shows up at your door. Come yep. back with a warrant. I'm not speaking to you without a lawyer. Nothing the fuck else. No, I mean, actually, honestly, yeah, this is the first time mom has given him good advice. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it, like, you know, I feel really bad for her because it's like, she's also the only person in Bobby Fischer's life who ever attempts to stop him from playing chess. Mm-hmm. But she does this by going to like chess psychiatrists and being like, is he addicted to chess? But they're all chess psychiatrists. And they're like, no.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to get good information from a yeah. chess psychiatrist.
So, okay. Later on in life, Bobby Fischer's going to get absolutely obsessed with the idea that he's being spied on and people like coming to kill him. And on the one hand, okay. this is just like his own sort of like dissent and conspiracy theories. But on the other hand, like, it's hard to argue about the fact that the U.S. government was in fact spying on him for a bunch of his life, like did not play a role in this.
I mean, given the period of time that this is, if you are someone who is even moderately prominent in a thing that might put you in contact with people outside of the United States, you're yep. being spied on by the U.S. government.
One of the big things happens is Bobby Fischer is trying to go to the USSR to play against the Russian chess players.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the Americans hate this. But, okay, so the larger backstory here is because Bobby Fischer is now the U.S. chess champion, he gets invited to this, like, tournament in Yugoslavia. And if you place high enough in this tournament, you get a chance to be in another tournament. And if you win that tournament, you can become the world. You can play the world yeah. champion and become the world champion. So he goes to this thing, right? And while he's in Yugoslavia, well, he has to go to Yugoslavia, but he's like, okay, I'm going to go to the Soviet Union because it's like close. And the Soviets okay. are like, sure, 15-year-old Bobby Fischer, like you can come be a guest in our country because you're good at chess. So Fischer shows up to the USSR and like he like steps off the plane and just immediately starts demanding that the Soviets like bring out their best chess players to play him. The Soviets are like, really, dude, like we brought you here as a guest and you are yelling at us to bring out your best chess players. So eventually they bring out a guy named Petrosian, who is like, this guy is 4 years out from becoming the world champion. Like, he is a good, he's like good at chess.
Pretty
right?
good at chess, yeah.
But Fischer's pissed off because he's not the current world champion. And then immediately Fischer starts asking how much he's going to get paid for playing Petrosian. And Petrosian's like, what the fuck are you talking? What do you mean? You came like
the Soviet
here.
Union. We have no money.
They have money. Yeah. It's it becomes clear very quickly in the story. They do in fact have money. But he's like what do you mean? Like you came to stay as a guest here, and now you are demanding to get paid money for playing us? Like, what is happening here? You know, and Fischer just gets progressively more and more mad as this goes on, because he wants to play like actual tournament games, and they're just playing like speed chess. And he just gets like progressively angrier. And okay, so there is a very important event in the life of Bobby Fischer that happens next, and there's a lot of disputes over what exactly happens. The claim at the time was that Fischer, like, standing right next to his, like, English, like, his English translator starts yelling about, like, quote, these Russian pigs. This is the way that I've seen it reported in a lot of the sort of books and articles about him. And this is what gets reported to the Russian press. Frank Brady, who's Fischer's biographer, claims that Fischer actually said pork and was complaining about his food, but the translator confused the word for pork and pig.
Okay.
But whatever happens, like, this turns into sort of like a firestorm, right? Because, you know, this American kid came here and then starts screaming about Russian pigs. And the Soviets are like, okay, you, like, can't stay here now. And, okay, so this means that Bobby still has time before this tournament. And he's like, okay, where am I going to go? And then from left field, by God, is that Tito's music?
Oh, shit. Oh, shit. Is he coming in with a steel chair?
Yep. He is. He is about to beat the shit out of who was in power in the Soviet Union at this point. Probably Khrushchev. He's about to hit Khrushchev from the high wire with a steel chair.
God, man, I just, every time Tito comes into a story, you know, things are about to get fun. But you know what else makes things fun?
Is it the products and services that support this podcast? Is it
them? That's, you're goddamn right. There's nothing besides buying products and services that makes anyone happy. And that's the truth. That's science. That's mathematics.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
My name is Johnny B. Good, and I'm the host of the new podcast, Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. Over this 9-part series, I'll explore the life and crimes of my best friend, Ray Trapani.
I always wanted to be a criminal.
If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
You see, Ray has this unique ability to find loopholes and exploit them.
They collected $30 million. There were headlines about it.
His company, Centratech, was one of the hottest crypto startups in 2017. It was going to change the world, until it didn't.
I came into my office, opened my email, and the subject heading was FBI request.
It was only a matter of time before the truth came out.
You can only fake it till you make it for so long before they find out that your Harvard degree is not so crimson.
How could you sit there and do something that you know will objectively cause more harm in the world?
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of Bitcoin, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. All right, please continue, Mia.
So Bobby is getting kicked out of the Soviet Union. Yugoslavia, who is like the great socialist enemy of the USSR, swoops in and is like, hey, Bobby Fischer, yeah, come here, play our Grandmasters. It'll be great. And, you know, Fischer is like incredibly happy about this. And I just got to say this, man, Tito, old buddy, this man is going to do things to your country that if you found them out would cause all of your organs to explode simultaneously. Like, you should have left him to the Soviets. But unfortunately, Tito offers hospitality to this terrifying American man. And, you know, the product of this is that Fischer, like, goes to Yugoslavia and loves it there. And for, like, the rest of his life, he's going to, well, okay. And this is where we need to be sort of careful. He's going to like Belgrade a lot, specifically.
Hell yeah.
This is going to become important later.
Hey, Belgrade's dope city. Love it.
Yeah.
If you want to get a pile of perfectly cooked processed meat walked to you by a waiter who is actively smoking a cigarette over the plate and enjoy the entire experience, Belgrade is the city for you. I mean that unironically. Great town. Love it.
Yeah, Fischer, I don't know. He just enjoys that a lot and other stuff that he's doing there, question mark. We'll get into that a little bit. Okay, so he's playing this tournament, right? And everyone expects him to just sort of bomb out because he's like 15. But instead, what he does is he draws like a bunch of the best players in the world. And, you know, and he beats some people. He draws like three of the best Soviet players. And somehow, you know, this like 15-year-old kid from the absolute provincial backwater United States, like qualifies for the Champions Tournament and simultaneously becomes the youngest Grandmaster in history. And it's at this point that everyone starts to lose their minds for Bobby Fischer.
Okay.
Like, all over the American chess scene, everyone's suddenly talking about, like, oh my God, there's this kid who could beat the Soviets at chess. Like, he gets a full editorial in the New York Times. Suddenly there's this, like, there's like the great white hope against the Soviet chess machine. And, you know, from this point on, like, everything that he does just becomes, like, in layered and, like, levels and layers and layers and layers and layers of propaganda. Because the U.S. had finally done the thing that it always does when it needs to fight communism. They had found their own Nazi. So, okay, even at, like, this age, Bobby is very, very anti-Semitic. He's better at hiding it than he's going to be later on. But he is doing stuff like, for example, the Encyclopedia Judaica, I put him in on their list of like famous Jewish people because his parents are Jewish, and he writes them a letter saying he is not Jewish and they need to take him off his list. And then he starts doing something he's going to do for the entire rest of his life, which is threaten to whip out his dick to show that he's not circumcised and thus not Jewish.
Wow.
Which
well,
is
I
like,
mean, can't argue with that. Perfect evidence there.
I don't know. I have nothing on this. It is a very, very weird kind of anti-Semitism. And I need everyone to, like, okay, whenever you think of Bobby Fischer, you need to understand that he is at all times two steps away from just whipping out of his dick to prove how not Jewish he is. Like, he's going to, like, there's going
to
be another time he does
to bring racism into the proud tradition of whipping out your dick at a chess tournament. That's heartbreaking.
Yeah, he is a wildly weird anti-Semitic person. There's another story of his sort of early anti-Semitism. So in 1962, he's doing this interview. He's, I think, how old is he? Like 18 or 19 at this point. There's this Harper's Magazine interview where He says, quote, "Yeah, there are too many Jews in chess. They have taken away the class of the game. They don't dress too nicely. That's what I don't like." And I want to remind everyone here that, like, okay, Bobby Fischer is about to become, like, the, like, literally the symbol of American chess, right? And you know, a genuine sort of geopolitical and moral hero of the U.S. And this was just in Harper's Magazine? Like, he just said that? He's,
wow.
It's not like he's saying this to, like, I don't know, like a tiny village paper in, like, rural Idaho or something. Like the journalists actually read this, right? But, you know, this is something that's going to happen time and time again in the story, is that, like, the press is just like, they'll see him say something like this, and then they're going to see some pretty good chess, and they're just instantly going to forget about it, and everyone's going to go back to comparing him to, like, Mozart and, like, Picasso, and immediately forget what he thinks about the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a literal Nazi, but he's good at chess, so who can say if it's bad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, but back to him being good at chess for a little bit. Fischer qualifies for the Candidates Tournament, which is, this is a tournament where, like, if you win it, you get the right to challenge the World Championship. And, like, almost immediately after he gets there, he makes history by becoming the first Grandmaster ever to get into a fist fight with another Grandmaster at a chess tournament.
Okay, now that's dope. That's good. That's like Adam amazing. Sandler and fucking Happy Gilmore.
Yeah. So, all right. Mm. So
I respect that. Look, he's a Nazi, but that's pretty funny.
Yeah. And then he does another very, there's another very famous Bobby Fischer thing that happens here. I'm just going to read this from Endgame. Henry Stockhold, a chess player who was covering the match for the Associated Press, brought Bobby to a brothel one night and waited for him. When Bobby exited an hour later, Stockholm asked him how he enjoyed it, and Bobby's comment, which he repeated other times, has been quoted, "Chess is better."
Huh.
So, this is a incredibly weird dude.
Yeah.
Unfortunately for Bobby, he just gets, like, destroyed in this tournament. And this leads to basically what becomes the Bobby Fischer chess special. He immediately starts screaming about how the entire tournament was rigged. And this is, like, enough that he gets an entire, like, giant, I think it was like a front cover piece in Sports Illustrated called "The Russians Have Fixed World Chess." And okay, so this is kind of true. What was happening at these tournaments is that the Soviets would play these, like, fast draws against each other, so that they could, like, preserve their energy for when they had to play non-Soviet players. But also there was endless analysis of this that's done by, like, people then and people now. And basically what they concluded was, like, okay, so the Soviets win every tournament, but the Soviets win every tournament because they have more good chess players than anyone else does.
I mean, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. But Bobby is convinced it's because they're just, like, cheaters. And he gets really, really angry at this. And, you know, he's already nursing this grudge from the Soviets, like, kicked him out. And so at this point, he basically just, like, swears eternal revenge on the Soviet Union, to the point where he refuses to play any tournaments that the International Chess Federation puts on, because he's like, the International Chess Federation is, like, a tool of the Soviets. And
I mean,
from here,
okay, man. Like,
yeah, well, okay, so this is, you know, as much as I've been saying he's rude, this is where he starts to get really weird. So there's this, like,
yeah, because, like, I guess it's like, that's like a little fucky what they were doing, but that's not really cheating,
yeah, it's not really,
right?
No,
like, if you're playing them, you're still just playing a game of chess. Like, they haven't taken chess steroids. They're not hiding an extra queen up their sleeves.
No,
they're just, like, kind of coming in a little fresher than you because they fucked around slightly. But I don't know. Cheating seems like a weird way to phrase that.
Yeah. And he gets utterly, like, on his, like, deathbed, he is going to be yelling about how the Soviets cheated him and, like, stuff like that.
All right, man.
And, you know, okay, and partially, he turns into a kind of guy that is partly very recognizable and partly not. So his two favorite books in this period are 1984 and Animal Farm.
Oh,
so
boy.
So this is you know, things are going great.
I'm going to guess he didn't read a lot of other Orwell.
No, it's he'll amazingly, those are, like, the two most normal things he's going to read from here on out. He also, like, he starts listening to my ancient enemy, the evangelical preacher Billy Graham.
Oh, no, no,
and then,
no.
And then he discovers a man named Herbert W. Armstrong's Radio Church of God.
Oh, no, no, not Armstrong. Oh, so, boy.
We should talk about Armstrong a little bit. Armstrong is, he's cut from the same cloth in a lot of ways.
We've mentioned him once or twice on the show. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I think he's technically Christian, but he's
Definitely technically Christian.
Well, here's the thing. He's not a Trinitarian. And at that point, I start looking at you real closely when you deny the Trinity as to whether or not you are actually a Christian. This is the line that I, someone who is not Christian, has imposed on Christianity. See how they like imperialism this once.
Have no opinion on that, but
Armstrong is like a real weirdo. He's a British Israelite, which is just like,
yeah,
weird.
I mean, these are the folks who believe that like British people are the real Jews and Jews aren't real. Like the actual Jewish people are not actual Jewish people. There's a bunch of weird, like it, this kind of feeds into the creativity movement. And
we're going to get to that a little bit too.
Good.
Yeah.
Huzzah.
There's a lot of things that he like, gets involved with. Fisher he doesn't quite join the church because there are some like prescriptions on stuff that the church has rules about, like you're not supposed to date anyone outside the church, and Fisher's like, this is stupid. So he doesn't technically join the church, but he's
good
like taking
for you,
Bible
Bobby,
classes
for fighting
from them.
The power.
Yeah, but he also picks up something that like he picks up basically these guys are also sort of like, I don't know if proto is the right term, but they're basically like Christian Science people, so they like don't believe in doctors. And they don't believe in vaccinations. And Fisher like picks this up. He like is really hardcore on this don't go to doctors thing. And he also starts tithing the church 10% of his income.
Dope.
And the other thing he starts doing around this period is he starts carrying around this blue cardboard box everywhere that he goes. And he would just refuse to open it. Everyone would he's just walking around carrying this blue cardboard box. And everyone's like, okay, Fisher, like what is this blue cardboard box? And he'd just get really mad when anyone asked him. And one time he finally like relented to the pressure and opened it, and inside of the box was the Bible. Which,
oh my God.
Like, this is something that like a youth pastor would, the story like a youth pastor would tell. That's like one of those, like, this child's name
really
was Albert Einstein.
Really simping for
jokes.
Jesus there, buddy.
Yeah, it's, so he gets very weird. So this goes on for like a couple, he has a couple of years of being wrapped in his, like, I'm not going to play for FIDE. I'm not going to, he plays like very little chess, but eventually FIDE is able to sort of like entice him back to like play chess again by like changing the format of the world's tournament. So like people couldn't, the candidates tournaments, people can't collude. And so Bobby Fischer like goes into this tournament and he just trivially easily destroys like three Soviet grandmasters. And he very, very quickly and incredibly decisively, I mean, he just annihilates them. And this means that he has the right to challenge the world champion, Boris Spassky, who at this point, Spassky is like one of the few people on Earth that Fischer has never beaten. But, you know, this is a sensation in the U.S. Suddenly, like, you know, back when he like qualified for the candidates tournament, like chess, like there was some coverage of it and like chess people were talking. Now, like, everyone knows who Bobby Fischer is. Like, sure. In the entire country, this is like everyone, and suddenly everyone's into chess too. Like, it's on the front page of the New York Times. Every TV station is covering it.
Like when people briefly cared about hockey because of that team fought the Soviets.
Yeah, yeah, and like this is basically the 1970s version of like the Magnus Carlsen Hans Nielmann like cheating butt plug thing, and it sparks like until basically literally this month, probably like the greatest chess boom America has ever seen. And, you know, okay, so this is a, like, nobody really cares about chess. What's actually happening here is this is basically a American nationalism and sort of anti-communism. And Fischer is seen by everyone, like, including himself, as a cold warrior, a term that people took, like, incredibly seriously at this time. And now sounds like the tag off for, like, a ripoff Mortal Kombat character.
Yep.
And, you know, okay, like, the stated reason for this is that, like, chess is, like, a big deal to the Soviets. It's ideologically important. Like, Lenin, like, played chess and wanted everyone to play chess.
Yeah, we gotta The Cold War was quite a time.
This is the thing you have to understand about the Cold War is every single person on the face of the earth is completely insane during this entire period, right? This match has literally no effect on the Cold War. Nothing. It does nothing. There was never a chance it could even conceivably have done anything. And I want everyone to keep this in mind as I tell the story of this world championship, because by the end of the story, the president of the United States is going to be personally involved in getting Bobby Fischer to play this game. Like, this is a game of chess. They're just playing chess. This is everyone is completely deranged. So, okay. Now that we've prefaced this with the fact that, like, nobody involved with this is even remotely sane. Bobby Fischer is like, okay, he's headed into his, like, world championship match with Boris Spassky. They're going to play a bunch of games. One of them's going to win. There's a huge fight about the location that, frankly, doesn't matter. They settle on Iceland. This tournament, you know, it's going to be a huge deal. It has the largest prize pool of all time for a chess match. And Bobby Fischer takes a look at the most money a chess player has ever received for playing chess and is like, no, I want a bigger cut of the ticket sales. And they're like, Bobby, like, if you take money from the ticket sales, like, we're going to lose money on this. And he's like, I don't care. I literally will not play unless you give me money from the ticket sales. And they think he's bluffing, but he's not bluffing. He cancels his flight from New York to Iceland because they won't, like, pay him more. And this is also very funny because the head of the Icelandic Chess Federation, who's, like, the guy who's been organizing this whole thing, is a very hardcore anti-communist, right? And he's trying to use this whole match as anti-communist propaganda. But, you know, you get what you pay for, buddy. Like, yeah, you want to do anti-communist propaganda? Have fun dealing with, like, this absolute capitalist asshole who just keeps extorting you literally every 5 seconds. And, okay, so this sort of saga of Fischer like refusing to show up to Iceland continues until a chess journalist calls this British investment banker named Derek Slater, who puts like $900,000 in today's money into the prize pool in order to get Fischer to play.
Huh.
And Fischer's still like, yeah. And at this point, Henry fucking Kissinger makes a personal call to Bobby Fischer and says, you have to play this game for America. The United States of America requires you that you play this chess game. And this finally convinces Bobby to play. Now, the other thing that's very weird about this is, okay, so this is like, you know, high Cold War drama, right? So you would expect that Fischer's opponent, who is Boris Spassky, like the darling of the Soviet chess machine, you would expect him to be a communist.
Yeah.
But no, he's a czarist.
Oh, no.
Here is a quote from Spassky. As for my views, I'm a Russian nationalist, and there's nothing scary about that. Don't be afraid. Some say that Russian nationalist is a nasty thing, most definitely an anti-Semite, a racist, a national-Bolshevik. No, for a nationalist, God exists and nations that respect each other. I'm a convinced monarchist. I remained a monarchist during the Soviet years and never tried to hide that. I believe the greatness of Russia is connected to the activity of the national leaders represented by our czars.
Wow. strong take. Okay.
I talked about this a bit earlier, but like this was the moment where I finally just became convinced that I spent like a bunch of time trying to find like a super grandmaster who has like normal-ish politics. And the thing that I realized, yeah, there's something about just spending all your time playing chess that drives you completely mad. Like, all of these people have the most nonsense politics I've ever seen. Like, it's like looking through a poll board. And you just find, you find ideologies that are like, how are you a czarist in like 2003? Like, what is happening here?
I mean, there are still czarists today. Like,
yep.
There's many, many monarchists on Twitter, at least, that you can find. And if you go to YouTube and you look up like Russian imperial anthems and stuff from the czarist era, you will find people being like, for the days of Nikolai II. I'm also not surprised that a chess guy in specific would be a monarchist. It is low-key a monarchist
game. It is true. But the thing that's weird about this, right, is like all of the sort of like all of the like every single like major communist, I don't know if actually Stalin did, but like every like major communist person, like Tito plays chess, Lenin plays chess, Che Guevara at one point like helps Fischer play a tournament in Cuba, like everyone plays chess, and then all of their chess players are like weird fascists and none of them are communists. It's oh god,
I don't know. I'll never understand chess, so I But clearly, if you like chess a lot, you're problematic. So I think we can say that for certain.
It's true. This is how I get canceled.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, I'm just gonna read a quote about Endnotes about what from Endgame about what Bobby Fischer does when he like finally shows up in Iceland after getting personally called by Henry Kissinger. Several hours later, coming home from bowling in the early hours of the morning, before returning to the hotel, Bobby sneaked into the playing hall to check out the conditions. After an 80-minute inspection, he had a number of complaints. He thought the lighting should be brighter. The pieces of the chess set were too small for the squares of the custom-built board. The board itself was not quite right. It was made of stone, and he thought wood would be preferable. Finally, he thought that the two cameras hidden inside burlap-covered towers might be distracting when he began to play, and the towers themselves looming over the stage like medieval battering rams were disconcerting. So he is showing up at like 4 a.m. and he walks into the hall and he just starts bitching about all like the chess pieces are the wrong size. And so, okay, the tournament organizers are like, whatever, we need this game to happen. And they're just desperate for this match to happen. And, you know, okay, so chess starts to be played. But in the words of John Boyce, who cares about that? Midway through game one, Bobby Fischer starts complaining that one of the cameras in the back is distracting. So the game like adjourns for the day. There's a thing in this period where like you play 40 moves and then everyone leaves and goes home and you come back and finish the game the next day. So Fischer comes in, he plays one move, and then he stands up on live TV, walks to the backstage, and spends 35 minutes of his own game time with his clock ticking down, screaming at the organizers to take down the camera. And okay, they eventually give in. But the next day, the game is supposed to start, and Fischer is nowhere to be seen. Fischer's team shows up. His team is sort of like lawyers and like advisors. They show up, and they tell them that Bobby Fischer will not play unless all cameras are removed from the venue.
Oh my God, Bobby! Jesus, what a fucking prima donna!
We are like maybe in the early mid game of Bobby doing this shit in this tournament. Okay, so. He then refuses to even show up to the hall to see if the accommodations, the organizers were like, okay, we'll move cameras. And he won't even show up to like check if they're fine. So, you know, he's not there. So the game starts, right? And Spassky's like, okay, I'm going to start the game clock. And Fischer is just still in his bed, like in his underwear in his hotel. And eventually the organizers are like, okay, fine. For one game, we will remove all the cameras. And Fischer goes, I'm not going to show up unless you give me back all of the time on my chess clock that I spent yelling, like arguing with you about removing these cameras. And the organizers finally are like, come on, man, like there has to be a line. Like you can't just not show up to your match and then demand we give you all of your time back because you were arguing with us. So and they everyone at every point in the story like expects Fischer's going to compromise. He just doesn't. He just does not show up for this game.
Okay. And
yeah, so we're now on day four, right? And the organizers are like, Fischer is like, okay, we need to wipe this game from the record. I didn't lose this game. You have to like forget that I didn't show up. And they're like, come on, like you didn't show up to this game. And so Fischer books a flight home to the U.S. So it is now day four. Of the World Chess Championship. Fischer is still refusing to play. The New York Times on its front page publishes an article begging him to play. Like,
that's sad.
Yeah, he gets a second call.
New York Times, don't fucking simp for a fascist. Impossible challenge.
Henry Kissinger calls him again. Richard Nixon personally invites him to the White House. in order to try to get him
that
to play
is the
this
least
game.
Least surprising part of this story. Also, well, the fact that Henry Kissinger would negotiate badly.
Oh yeah, it's and you know, okay, we could reasonably ask ourselves at this point, why is the Secretary of State and the President of the United States getting involved to make sure some like random asshole anti-Semite plays a chess game? And the answer is that, like, insofar as this game is important anyway, it's because, you know, it's about, like, symbols and sort of myths. And Spassky is, like, the representative of, like, the bureaucratic, like, terror apparatus of the Soviet Union who's being challenged by, like, this, like, lone individual manic genius of the free world. But, like, okay, if you take about 2 seconds to think about what the U.S. is doing while this is going on, right? Okay, like, what is Kissinger doing? And the answer is using one of the, like, literally one of history's largest, most like, bureaucratic organizations to deliver munitions from Tennessee to Tokyo in order to burn children alive in Vietnam and Cambodia to, you know, prop up an incredibly corrupt and tyrannical narco-dictatorship. So, you know, in some sense, right, Fisher is like he is kind of someone the Americans need, right? He's someone that like someone like Kissinger or someone like Nixon needs to be the sort of like individualist hero to match the Soviets' collective hero, because otherwise everyone is going to start asking questions about the fact that like we also have our own terror bureaucracy that is like murdering everyone in the street. But like, no, hey, look, it's Bobby Fischer. We're going to like wave this like shiny trinket in front of you and be like, he is all of us. And then meanwhile, like, okay, like the great American collective hero is sitting in his underwear, refusing to play chess because there's cameras in the room. And even after all of this, Fisher is still refusing to play. And what eventually convinces him is that, like, Boris Spassky, who by all rights at this point could simply have gone, I beat him, he refused to play me again, I'm going home. Yeah. He's like, fine, I will look, like, I will go talk to him, we'll play a game, be like backstage where there's no cameras. And Fisher, like, finally having gotten literally everything that he wants out of his temper tantrum, like, waits until 90 minutes before the match is going to start and finally agrees to play. So the match starts again. Fisher makes one move, jumps out of his seat, and starts screaming at the organizers that there's a camera again. And at this point, Spassky, who is, like, he has been putting up with Fisher's bullshit for, like, months now, just snaps and just, like, walks out of the room. And this one referee has to convince both Spassky and Fisher that they should actually play this game. And eventually this guy, who like absolutely should have had Kissinger's job because he's apparently just a miracle worker, like manages to convince both of them to play the game. And at this point, like the game after like a litany of bullshit, 2 calls from the Secretary of State, like cash infusions from British bankers, The thing, like, finally gets going. And meanwhile, in the U.S., like, this is such a big deal.
Well, it's,
that
a
PBS...
good it's a good thing there's no other problems happening in the world at this point.
Oh, God, yeah.
That these people, like, could be focusing on.
Yeah, like...
This was the number one thing happening at the time.
Yeah. Well, okay, we're going to get something about that. So PBS puts together a special program specifically just to broadcast these games. This is watched by over 1 million people. Here's from Endgame. So popular was the show that it crowded out the baseball and tennis coverage normally seen in sports bars in New York. And when the channel was covering the Democratic National Convention in Washington, the stations were flooded with thousands of calls to have them put the chess match back on. Station officials gave in to the viewers' demands, dropped the convention, and went back to broadcasting the match. Oh, God. So, okay, people love chess mania, but like back in the match, like nothing interesting happens. It's not a very good match. Both of them are playing kind of badly. Fisher wins. And then he shows up to his medal ceremony. And then in order to complain that there's not, his name isn't engraved on the medal.
Huh?
And that is, that is Fisher winning the chess world championship. You know, he, at this point, you know, Fisher is an American hero, right? Like,
sure,
even
sounds
he's
like
done
one.
All this stuff.
Yeah,
he is a profoundly American figure, and he comes back to the U.S.
That is undeniable. He sounds extremely American.
It's amazing. So he comes back to the U.S. and he gets like he has a just infinite number of sponsorship deals and like branding stuff, and everyone wants to talk to him, and he just turns them all down. Here's one last thing from Endgame. The most fabulous offer came to Fisher in 1974, right after the Muhammad Ali George Foreman fight, known as the Rumble in the Jungle in Zaire. The Zaire government offered Fisher $5 million, I think that's like $40 million or something in modern money, to play Anatoly Karpov in their country in what would have been a month-long championship chess match. Too short, said Bobby. How dare they offer me $5 million for a month-long match? This is $30 million in today's money. Ali received Jesus twice Christ. That much for one night. He didn't. Muhammad Ali did not get $10 million. No.
No, but and, also Muhammad Ali's, the sport that he played involved him destroying his brain by getting his skull smashed. So yes, okay. I understand why he might get more money.
Yeah. Okay. Get this fucking next line. It was after that match that Ali began calling himself the greatest. And Bobby took issue with that, too. Ali stole it from me, said Bobby. I used the greatest for myself on television before he ever used it.
Okay, Bobby. You don't get to copyright the term the greatest.
Yeah, and you don't get to complain that Muhammad Ali is using it.
No, you know what? I think we should do a hybrid chess boxing match between Ali
I would have loved to see
Fisher.
That. Ali would have murdered him. It would have been amazing. That man would have died in the ring.
Mm-hmm. It would have been very funny.
Unfortunately, chess boxing will not become a popular thing until 2 months ago. So rest in peace.
We do. Yeah.
And this is where we're going to leave Fisher here for today at the absolute peak of his fame.
Amazing.
And yelling at Muhammad Ali for calling himself the greatest because he did it first.
I think we can all agree chess was a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mia, you want to plug your pluggables before we ride out?
Yeah, so I do a show called It Could Happen Here that Robert is also on sometimes.
I am.
And other people are also on, and it's good, and you should listen to it. And I'm also at itmechr3 on Twitter if you'd want to be there for some reason. Yeah.
Yeah. I have a book called After the Revolution. You can buy it by typing it into any place that sells books, Amazon or bookshop.org or whatever that place is. Or just go to the AK Press website. You can buy After the Revolution everywhere. All right, folks, until next week, go play Warhammer, you know? Engage with the true sport of strategic masters, the one that has a lot of chainsaws in it.
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.